So we've been working through a series thinking about finding Christ in the Old Testament. And as I've been doing this, right, so we started, we did the Genesis accounts, right? And so we looked at starting Genesis 1 all the way up through the midpoint of Genesis 9. And there's something interesting about that as sort of a cohesive unit is what we found, right? So we see in that, it turns out, the complete story of Christ. We find Christ the creator. We find Christ the ultimate victor over the serpent, over the dragon, Satan. We find him as the death and the resurrection and the shedding of the blood. We find the cleansing nature of all of the world being cleansed through the flood and through Christ's ultimate work. And so there's this really great set of stories there early on that you can imagine you just picked up the book of Genesis and that's all you had. You can find the complete gospel message right there in that story. And it looks complete to me. I mean, in other words, I looked at that and I thought, wow, that's really neat. That's really complete. So I finished that sermon. And then, of course, Mark walks up to me right after that last sermon and the flood. And he says, now you got to go on and do the next part. And I looked at him and said, there's a problem there. First of all, we've got this completeness. And second, the next big story that we would tell is the Tower of Babel story. And as I mentioned to him, I've already preached on the Tower of Babel story. I've already done that sermon, Mark. And he looked a little puzzled, right? Like, because he doesn't remember it. So I went back and looked it up, and I did do it. It was in 2003, so that was a while ago. And so part of this is like I've done it. But then he also noted, he says, no, don't worry. When you look at it, you'll find something new in there. And he was right. So we're going to tell the story of what comes after the flood now. And it turns out, it's really interesting. I don't know why I'm always surprised when you go back and look at these things at just how deeply interesting it is when you start looking at it, trying to find the sort of, where's the story of Christ in it? And so the background here, right? The background here is we've just had the flood. And so in the last time we talked about this, we ended with the rainbow, because that is a happy ending, right? God puts a rainbow in the sky, says, I will never destroy the earth again. The earth has been cleansed. It's no longer cursed, right? We've got just sort of this marvelous new beginning going on. And part of the marvelous new beginning is one change, right? There's one really interesting change from the last new beginning. The last new beginning we can think of is when human and woman are cast out of the Garden of Eden, and they're going to go start this new society. And now Noah comes out of the ark, and we're going to start a new society. But part of the story of the rainbow is this, Genesis chapter 9. God hands down the law. Now, God had not handed down the law before. If you remember back in the Eden story, right, when human and woman are cast out, God does not give them any orders or rules or things they need to follow. But this time, when Noah comes out of the ark, God does give them a rule. It's in Genesis chapter 9. Pick up in verse 4. But you must not eat meat that has lifeblood still in it. And for your lifeblood, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal. And from each man too. I will demand an accounting for the life of his fellow man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God, God has made man. As for you, be fruitful and increase in number, multiply on the earth and increase upon it. He gives a command, and the command is, don't kill other people. And you want one rule God's going to hand down. He's going to hand down this one rule. Don't kill other people. Now, why that rule of all rules? And it's not hard to figure out. Think back to the last time we started afresh. Human and women are cast out of the Garden of Eden, and then they go out and they have kids, and what's the first thing that happens? Cain kills Abel. So at least we're correcting that problem, right? We now get to restart, and at least we're not going to replay the murder right away. We're not going to have the brothers murdering each other. God has made it clear, in case it wasn't clear before, don't murder your brother, right? Don't go out and kill anyone. That's our new rule. We now have this cleansed earth. The curse is lifted off the ground. This is marvelous. We're not going to murder each other. And you imagine now where this story is going to go. And if you're just reading it, you're thinking, this is great. We had all those problems. We've corrected all the problems. We're starting afresh. We've ruled out the one big problem that created all the havoc last time. We are now going to have a great story of humans going out and worshiping God and rainbows in the sky. It's going to be beautiful. And what's the first story we get? The very first story after the flood. Genesis chapter 9. Pick up in verse 18. The sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. These were the three sons of Noah, and from them came the people who were scattered over the earth.
That's great, right? All of the earth has been destroyed. Everybody's dead except the people that were in the ark. And now we've got Noah and his three sons, and they're going to go out and spread, and they're going to populate the earth. This is great. Noah, a man of the soil, proceeded to plant a vineyard. When he drank some of the wine, he became drunk and lay uncovered inside his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father's nakedness and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it across their shoulders. They then walked backwards and covered their father's nakedness. Their faces were turned the other way so that they would not see their father's nakedness. That is the first flood story. We do not tell this story in children's Sunday school. We skip right over it in all the children's Sunday school lessons, right? I mean, why? It's hard to imagine, right? And you look at what just happened. Think about Noah. Noah, who was told, we were told when we met him, he is a righteous man. He is named Noah because he's going to lift the curse of the land off, right? That's the sort of the promise, and he does that. He's a righteous man before God. He does all that God commands him. Noah is heroic. He's great. He's amazing. He comes out of this magnificent experience watching God save him from the destruction of the earth, and the first thing he does is he gets drunk and gets naked. It's like the New Year's Eve party you were at, right? I mean, you're all imagining that's it, but it's not that at all. Think about this story in the context of what we've read so far in Genesis. Noah has done what here? He got drunk, right? That's already, and so he's acting a little wild here, but then he gets naked. What do we know about nakedness from the story of Genesis? This is not the first time we've encountered nakedness in the story of Genesis. The first time we encountered nakedness was human and woman in the garden, they sin, and the first thing they realize after they sin is we are naked, and they are ashamed, and they cover up. Nakedness in this story is this sign of all of the shame of sin. And it's this thing that we are told right away is not good. It captures all of this thing about us in our rebellion against God. And they cover up. And then we move through Genesis and everybody's wearing clothes. Except suddenly Noah strips and is naked. And the shock of that, if you're imagining just reading this story, is, what is Noah doing here? This is shameful, what Noah is doing here. This is the sort of thing that should embarrass us. We should be looking at our hero and saying, Noah, not a good move here. This is not where we want you to be going. You know God has just destroyed the whole world because of the sinfulness and wickedness of man. And here you are. Ugh, I mean, it just isn't pretty. And so suddenly our hero falls a bit, right? Right away our hero falls a bit. He was the man after God's heart. He was the guy that God saved through all the world. And suddenly we find him doing something that we should look at him and say, But you know what we really should do? We shouldn't even be looking at him. Because that's exactly what happens. Ham walks in, sees his father, and tells about it. Shem and Japheth, by the way, hear Ham talking about it and are scandalized and appalled, and they go through that elaborate ritual of, I mean, think how hard that would have been, right? You put the blank there, and you're walking backwards in the tent trying to find where's Dad, so you can put the blanket down behind you while you're always looking the other way, so you never see Dad naked. That's what Shem and Japheth are doing. What is Ham doing then? Why are his brothers sort of hearing Ham tell this story, and they're just appalled? And what are they appalled about? They can't believe what Ham has just done. He walks in, he looks, and he comes out and he starts talking about it. And at one level, again, we have this oddity of, we just imagine, yeah, okay, you know, you walk in, somebody's naked, you go out and say, oh, somebody naked in there, right? I mean, that's sort of what we're imagining the story is. But again, we have to think back. What is this story doing here? I mean, why of all the events put, I mean, surely this wasn't the only time Noah sinned or the brothers sinned. What's going on here? And in order to think about that, we need to think about the genre of literature we're reading. And imagine you're reading Genesis way back at the time it's being put together. And you're reading Genesis, and what you're reading then is, you're reading all of these stories of these ancient heroes, these ancient legends, your forefathers' forefathers' forefathers, these stories of these people of the past. And when we talk about telling these stories of these heroes of the past, the common word we use for that is mythology, right? We talk about the mythologies, right? And this early part of Genesis is the mythology. And mythology, since Christians, makes them a little nervous. Right? I can see some of the nervousness. Mythology doesn't mean it's not true, right? It just means that's the genre in which this is in. People in the old days used to believe the mythologies, right? So they have these stories. The stories are true stories, right? They're these stories of what happened. And if you're reading it in that genre, what is this story of Ham? Well, it will immediately remind you of stories from all the other cultures around. The stories of patricide. There is this constant refrain in old mythologies of the killing of the father. The most famous ones that we're familiar with are in the Greek mythologies, right? So in the Greek mythology, you have the great god Uranus. So he's sort of there, and he has these kids, and one of his kids is Cronos. Cronos comes along, wants to take over, because father's not that great, and so he castrates his father. Then Cronos becomes the king of the gods. He has kids. Zeus thinks Cronos is terrible, so Zeus comes along and castrates his father, right? Greek has two castration stories as sort of the rising up together. And now what do we read here? Imagine you know stories like that, and you're reading this story here, and Noah is naked in the tent, and the son comes in, and he sees the shame of his father, and he goes out and tells about the shame of his father. And what has Ham just done? He has killed off his father, metaphorically. He has said, "Dad used to be great. He was the guy that God found righteous. He was the guy God had build the ark. He was the one that led us through the flood. And you know what Dad really is?" You can hear him telling his brothers, "You all thought Dad was great. He's naked and drunk in the tent." And Ham is suddenly doing what? He's saying, "Dad isn't so great. He, in fact, he's a bit shameful. This is sort of embarrassing the way Dad is." And Shem and Japheth hear that and say, "Whoa, wait a minute here. We are not going to disgrace our father." And they walk backwards in the tent, and they cover him up. And then what happens after that? Noah wakes up from his drunken stupor, figures out what went on. Verse 24. When Noah awoke from his wine and found out what his youngest son had done to him, he said, "Cursed be Canaan. The lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers." He also said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem. May God extend the territory of Japheth. May Japheth live in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his slave." He comes out and he curses Ham's son Canaan. Curses him. Says, "You're going to be a slave to everyone now. Ham, your son is going to be the slave of all the other people. And these other brothers, by the way, their kids are all going to be ruling over all of your descendants." And at first glance, this seems like an odd curse, let's be honest. Who was the person who went into the tent, saw Noah, and went out and told about it? It wasn't Canaan. It was Ham. It was the father. And then Noah walks out and he curses, not Ham, he curses Canaan. Why? Well, this is also kind of interesting. The first interesting thing to note is this. When Noah says these words, "Cursed be Canaan, the lowest of the slaves will he be to his brothers," that is the first time Noah talks in the entire story. Noah has never said a word up till this point. He builds a whole ark, he brings in all the animals, he comes out, he sends out doves and ravens, does all of these things, but he never talks. He gets blessed, he offers a sacrifice, he never talks, and then suddenly Noah talks. And the first thing he does is what? He's cursing the son of Ham. And that curse makes a lot of sense in the context of the story itself. What has Ham done? He has dethroned his father. He has broken this link. Ham has come along and said, "My father is no longer worthy of adoration. My father is the recipient of what? Of the Noahite covenant." He's God to Noah, to Ham, and Ham is saying, no more. I'm going to break this connection between me and my father. And then Noah's immediate curse is, I'm going to break the connection between you and your sons. And suddenly, Canaan is cursed. You can imagine Canaan at this point. Canaan sitting here saying, gosh, why do I have to be a slave? Well, it's because of what Dad did, what my father did. And suddenly, we are setting up this pattern of the complete, let's get rid of all the authority above us. Ham got rid of the authority above it. Canaan is going to be off on his own, acting as a slave to everyone. And we're breaking these links one by one by one. And we hear Noah's curse, and while it makes sense, is that the right thing to do? Ham has done something wrong, and Noah comes along and curses the future generations. And it's kind of interesting. I mean, is it the right thing? Turns out the story is completely silent on whether or not this is a good thing to do. The story neither commends Noah nor curses Noah for doing this. And so then we immediately want to say, well, is Noah a good guy or a bad guy? Because if he's a good guy, it must be a good thing. If he's a bad guy, it must be a bad thing. So is Noah a good guy or a bad guy? Well, he is the guy who did the whole flood thing. That was good. But he's also the guy who was just drunk and naked in his tent. And so we have no way of knowing whether or not this is supposed to be a good cursing or a bad cursing. But what's really important about the cursing in this story is not do we praise or blame Noah for it. It's what comes after this. This story is there, not because the story in and of itself is the important moral lesson. The story is there because it sets up a pattern for us. And a pattern will then immediately be followed in the stories that come right after. And this story, this pattern is being born right away after Noah. Noah comes out of the ark, and immediately Ham breaks the connection with the father. We're done here, Dad. And I'm going to go out, and I'm going to now make the rules. And I'm going to decide how I'm going to live my life. And I'm going to figure out what the authority should be. And then Noah comes along and curses Canaan and says, you know what, Ham, your kids aren't even going to be alive. And we're just going to devolve here. And so we get this story, and then immediately following it is one of the genealogies, right? And the genealogies we're always glossing over, because let's be honest, reading a lot of names seems really boring. But in the middle of this genealogy, when we're reading about the sons of Ham, we suddenly get a little story. So the Hanites, they're about the middle of chapter 10, and then we're watching the sons of Ham, Cush, Mirzaim, Put, and Canaan. You skip down to verse 8. Cush was the father of Nimrod, who grew to be a mighty warrior on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. That is why it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. The first centers of his kingdom were Babylon, Erech, Akkad, Calneh, and Shinar. From that land he went forth to Assyria, where he built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Calah, Rezin, that which is between Nineveh and Calah, that is the great city. And we go on to more genealogies. Now this is a little bit of a weird, right? It's the interruption of this whole list of just these names. Suddenly we get Nimrod, the legendary Nimrod. There's a whole saying about him. He's a mighty hunter before the Lord. And again, we hear that and think, oh, hunter before the Lord. He must be really good. He goes out and shoots deer with bow and arrows, and it's really nice. And he's such a great hunter or something. And we think, what in the world? Why do we care about some guy who was just a good hunter back in those days? There were lots of good hunters back in those days. If you didn't have a good hunter in your tribe, you died, right? So what is it about Nimrod that made him such a great hunter, we think? And then we start noticing the oddity of Nimrod. What do we see about Nimrod? There's all these cities that get listed associated with him. And here we need the geography lesson. These cities are in a weird place. When we look at where the descendants of Ham are all settling, they are all over on the east coast of Africa. Ethiopia region is where you can think. That's where all of these people are. Nimrod has a whole bunch of cities, not on the east coast of Africa, but up in Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, that kind of an area. What in the world is Nimrod, whose ancestors are from the east coast of Africa, doing up in modern-day Iraq? How did he get there? How did he get so many cities? As suddenly we realize what a mighty hunter before the Lord is, what is he hunting? He's not hunting deer. He's hunting men. He is the great warlord. And he has gone forth from his ancestral homes, and he's ravaged throughout the land, and he's founding city after city after city, and he's building a great empire. And what is Nimrod doing? Nimrod is asserting, I no longer need to live where my ancestors live. I get to make the rules. And he goes out and conquers a whole swath of land and makes it his own. Nimrod is doing just what Ham did, discounting the fathers, going out, and building an empire. All right, why does that matter? And again, this sort of, oh, that's kind of interesting, but why does it matter? The next story, chapter 11. Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. They said to each other, come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower that the men were building. And the Lord said, if it is one people speaking the same language, they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other. So the Lord scattered them from there over the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. That is why it is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. This is a story we tell in Sunday school. It's the first one of these stories we tell in Sunday school, but we tell it all wrong in Sunday school, right? You tell it in Sunday school, and what we always do is, okay, look at these stupid people trying to build a tower up to heaven, right? They're going to build it all the way up to heaven, and then you draw the picture with this super tall tower, right? And you think about the super tall tower, and it's great when you're a kid and you're seven. You think, oh, yeah, they're building a tall tower. How stupid. Obviously, you can't get up to heaven, et cetera, et cetera. Except there's the problem with building a tower to heaven. How many stories up can you get with bricks and mortar in a tower if you're trying to go all the way up to the heavens before it falls over? Not very far. And you know what? They knew that in ancient times, right? This idea that a bunch of people would sit around and say, we're going to build a tower to heaven, and then you're thinking, what are the ladders they're going to get, right, to go? I mean, this whole story is just sort of silly thought about like that. Except fortunately, we don't have to think about it like that because the clues are all in the story. And the first clue is, where is this? In the plain of Shinar. Tower of Babel. Babel. Oh, that's Babylon. And we know where Babylon is. It's in Iraq. And there's a Babylonian empire that will show up eventually. So what we have here are people centered in Babylon, which eventually becomes the Babylonian Empire. And here's what we know about the Babylonian Empire. They used to build these giant towers near all the cities. And what were these giant towers? They were called ziggurats. Right? We found them, right? I mean, they're there, right? They're massive. They're 10, 11, 12 stories high, right? I mean, it's pretty high. There are these tiered platforms going up. And at the top of them is these astrological observatory-type things. They are a tower not going up to the heavens. They are a tower to the heavens, right? They're there, and you go up, and you worship the gods of the heavens at the top. And why are they building these giant towers? Well, here's an interesting problem. Imagine you're building a giant empire in the middle of desert, and you start in one city, and you say, okay, you need to go east and a little bit south to get to the next city. How do you find it? Well, you don't use your GPS, because you don't have it. In fact, you don't even have a good map. In fact, you don't even know about longitude and latitude yet. So how do you find it? Well, you just start walking or riding your camels or whatever it is, and you head out into the desert, and you hope you don't miss it. And what would be really useful way to not miss the city? It'd be really good if there are these super tall structures you can see from a long way away to say, oh, it's over there. Because without that tall structure, you might miss it and wander off to your death. So they would build these massive towers, and this is a great way to build an empire. And so here they are building a great empire. So we know what the towers are, but why is God so upset about markers in the sand to mark where the cities are? Sure, they have temples at the top to the gods, right? But whatever, there's temples all over the place, right? Why is this one so bad? And that is also embedded in the story. But again, we have to think back to the story we've seen till now. Here's the key thing. Verse 3. Come, let us make bricks. For reasons I don't know, I'm really amused by that. Make bricks is actually technically, let us brick bricks. Brick is both the verb and the noun, and that amuses me. So let us brick bricks and bake them thoroughly. They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. Then they said, and here's the important part, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth. That's the sentence that God is reacting to. And why is he reacting to that sentence? Well, again, think about this story, not just as an isolated story, but imagine you started in Genesis 1, you're reading forward. What are they doing here? They're building something. They're creating. And up till this point, who are the only creator in the story? The only creator of the story so far has been God. And then what did God do? He creates man in his own image. He creates us to be creators. So we have God the creator. We are created in the image of God. We're created to be creators. We have all of these creators. And what do they go create? Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves. Suddenly what they are doing is they have corrupted the entire creation story. They are created in the image of God, and now they're going to go out and create. And for whom are they creating? They're not creating for God. They're not creating to honor God. They are creating for themselves to make a name for themselves. We are creating the tower so that people will know whom to worship, whom to have awe for, whom to respect. They are creating and putting themselves in the place of God and saying, we will build this for ourselves. And God looks down and says, we're done here. We're absolutely done here. And he comes down and he says, look at what they're doing. And you can hear why he says, look at what they're doing. Think about the story we have. The last big story we told was the flood, where God wiped out all of humanity because what? Everything they did was right in their own eyes. That's the way they were acting. They were just doing what was good for themselves. And God looks down and says, I'm done here. Floods the earth. We start all over with Noah, and here we are, this far. I mean, we're not even that far along. And what do we have? We have a story of people doing things for themselves. It's just the same thing all over again. We have this breaking of the relationship with the Father. We have the murdering tyrant running around killing people. We have the people building a tower for themselves and putting themselves in this place of God and acting only for themselves. And we know what's going to happen next because God's already told us what happens next. The last time this happened, he floods the earth. So it's happened again, and he's going to, except he's not going to flood the earth this time, because he promised not to flood the earth this time. It's what he should do here. I mean, if God had it, I mean, obviously he should flood them all out, and let's try it. But he doesn't do that. What does he do instead? And this is stunning if you're reading this book along. The next thing he does, get another genealogy, chapter 12. The Lord said to Abram, leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. Immediately after the Tower of Babel story, where the people got together and said, let us make a name for ourselves so that people will see us, God dissipates them all, scatters the languages, and then the next story goes to Abram and said, I will make of you a great nation. God's going to build the great nation. And what will this nation that God builds look like? He didn't do this after the flood, you know. He just has Noah, goes out, kids go out, they do all this. And God finally says, you know what? This time, I'm now going to go build a great nation. And what is the main feature? The thing that's going to happen to this great nation, right? I will bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you. All the peoples on the earth will be blessed through you. And how will all the nations on the earth be blessed through Abram? How is that going to happen, that all the peoples on the earth are going to be blessed through this one guy that God's going to build a great nation for? And this is exactly the moment that Genesis switches from being just these sort of scattered stories to becoming this very detailed story of one guy, Abraham, and that guy's son, and that guy's son, and the 12 tribes of Israel's, and the birth of the nation, and the whole rest of the Old Testament is the story of Abraham and his descendants. We suddenly move from Genesis, from these grandiose sort of sketchy stories about all of humanity, to we're now going to tell the story of this one set of people. But it's just one set of people. It's not all the people on the earth. Where do we get all the people on the earth? Well, that's how Mark started the series. Matthew chapter 1. Matthew chapter 1 starts with a genealogy, which reminds us a lot of all those Old Testament Genesis genealogies. Who's the end of this genealogy? Jesus. Who's the first person mentioned in the genealogy? Abraham was the father of Isaac. It's like Matthew comes along and he's read Genesis up to this point and he gets the story and God says to Abraham, I will make of you a great nation and all the peoples of the world will be blessed. And then Matthew just sort of says, okay, we could have cut it right there and now we'll insert Matthew chapter 1. Abraham was the father of Isaac, was the father, and it would be just like it was in Genesis. And you can see it's clearly his intent. This sounds so much like Genesis, and you put it right in after the story of Abraham, and then what do we get? We get the message, this is all about Jesus, it turns out. Suddenly, the story has completely flipped on us. We had what looked like a recreation of the earlier story. The story of human and woman being cast out of the garden. Cain kills Abel. People become wicked. God floods the earth, destroys everybody, saving just Noah and his sons. Then Noah and his sons go out. Noah's sons break this covenant. They break the relationship. They go out. Suddenly they're all doing evil in the sight of everyone. But instead of flooding the earth this time, God comes along and says, here's the plan. And the plan is Jesus. Suddenly the gospel message, all encompassed in those first 9 or 8.5 chapters of Genesis, suddenly becomes, starting in the midpoint of Genesis chapter 9 up through 12, we get the same degradation, but starting in Genesis 12 through the rest of the book, we are watching the story of Jesus. And it's right there. How deep does it run? Well, it's not just that Abraham becomes the promise of Jesus. This image of Babel lingers too. Babel, they build this big tower, and in Daniel what we see, I don't read the story here, right? But in Daniel what we see is we see the king of Babylon, Babel, decides what? He's going to go build a giant statue, a giant tower in the plains, just like the Tower of Babel story, and all the world needs to bow down and worship it. And then it doesn't work out so well. And then in Revelation, right before the culmination of Revelation, when the new heaven and the new earth descend, we get this magnificent passage about the fall of Babylon the Great. Babylon becomes the motif straight throughout the scriptures of here is the city of people worshiping themselves, and against the city of the people worshiping themselves is the set of people worshiping God. So Abraham becomes the progenitor of Jesus. Babel becomes the stand-in for what's going to keep happening. And you see this conflict being built. And how does it resolve? Well, it resolves itself in a fascinating way. Because after Jesus' death and resurrection, what happens? He goes up to heaven. And then the first thing that happens after he goes up to heaven, everybody's gathered. We'll turn there. Acts. In the book of Acts, Jesus has just gone up to heaven. Everybody's gathered. They're huddled together in a room. Acts chapter 2. When the day of Pentecost came, they were all together in one place. Suddenly a sound like the blowing of a violent wind came from heaven and filled the whole house where they were sitting. They saw what seemed to be tongues of fire that separated and came to rest on each of them. All of them were filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak in other tongues as the Spirit enabled them. Now there were staying in Jerusalem God-fearing Jews from every nation under heaven. When they heard this sound, a crowd came together in bewilderment because each one heard them speaking his own language. Utterly amazed, they asked, "Are not all these men who are speaking Galileans? Then how is it that each of us hears them in their own native language? Parthians, Medes, and Elamites, residents of Mesopotamia, Judea, and Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt, and the parts of Libya near Cyrene, visitors from Rome, both Jews and converts to Judaism, Cretans and Arabs. We hear them declaring the wonders of God in our own tongues." Amazed and perplexed, they asked one another, "What does this mean?" What does it mean? What was the consequence of Babel? God scatters the languages of the earth, and suddenly people can no longer understand each other. And what is the consequence of Jesus' death and resurrection? Suddenly they can speak to one another again. We're all united again through Christ. We've ended that problem with Jesus. The entire story here, from the flood through the Tower of Babel, is telling the story of the fall of man again. But this time, instead of flooding the earth, God sends us Jesus. Let's pray. God, we thank you for your mercy. God, we thank you that even though we sin, even though we rebel, that God, you do not destroy us, but God, you sent your Son Christ. God, help us to live a life worthy of that calling that you've given to us. Help us live lives worthy of Christ. In his name we pray. Amen.